The Internet Multicasting Service presents the National Press Club Luncheon with speaker Carol Browner.
Program sounds something like something that could have been drafted by congressional Republicans. It's called the Common Sense Initiative. It aims to achieve the best public health and environmental protection for the least cost. And like Republicans, Browner has listened to industry's concerns, recently simplifying 25 environmental regulations and scaling back paperwork. She also has strived to build bridges between environmentalists and industry. Her proposed legislative reforms to the Superfund Toxic Waste Cleanup Program drew support from both the Sierra Club and the chemical manufacturing industry. Ending decades of California water wars, she negotiated water quality standards for San Francisco Bay, and she put in place broad protections for the Great Lakes. Though she may, at times, talk like a Republican and walk like a Republican, Ms. Browner is no Republican. She's a Democrat. And her relationship with the new Republican Congress is anything but a love fest. In truth, the honeymoon is over. High-profile fights have broken out over policies that will affect the quality of the earth for many years to come. When House Republicans embraced legislation requiring EPA to conduct lengthy and costly risk assessments before adopting new regulations, Ms. Browner lambasted them for perverting both science and common sense. No more Ms. Nice Guy. She declared that, quote, 20 years of protections for our children and our air and our land and our water are being rolled back in the dead of the night. She has similarly assailed proposed GOP revisions to the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. Republicans have retaliated by accusing her of illegally lobbying Congress and preparing a political hit list of GOP lawmakers. Ms. Browner has called the attacks an attempt to silence her. As we will see today, the EPA administrator will not be silenced. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club, Carol Browner.
Thank you, Bud, for that very warm and entertaining introduction. And I also want to thank Mark Johnson and Greg Gordon for the opportunity to be with you all today. In honor of the federal employees in Oklahoma City who lost their lives, their children, and their families, I would like to begin with a moment of silence. As the president said yesterday, this country will not tolerate terrorist actions, and those responsible will be swiftly brought to justice. This is a tragedy in our country, and our thoughts and prayers are with the people of Oklahoma City. I am pleased today to be joined by a visionary environmental leader, the father of Earth Day, Senator Gaylord Nelson. And I was telling him that I was able to watch a tape made some years ago in which he was interviewed about the first Earth Day, and he related the story of how the idea came to him as he was flying on an airplane across the country, that there was this great energy, this great concern in the people across the country, but their voices had to be heard. And so out of the grassroots and out of his leadership came the first Earth Day. And I don't think anyone could have believed on that day that 25 years later it would be a tradition, not just here in the United States, but around the world. It is because of leaders like Senator Nelson that we can celebrate the progress of environmental protection and look ahead to the challenges of the future. We are very grateful for the commitment and vision you brought to our efforts to save our environment. Thank you. Earth Day honors the very best of who we are, of our national character. 40 years ago, ordinary Americans decided that we could no longer tolerate racial discrimination, and Jim Crow was swept into history. 34 years ago, President John Kennedy challenged the nation to reach the moon, and 8 years later, we all watched as the American flag was planted on the lunar landscape. 25 years ago, 20 million Americans stood up and said, we must save our environment, and asked their government to protect those things which we all share. The progress that we have made in the last 25 years stems in large part from the belief of the Congress, the recognition of 6 presidents, beginning with Richard Nixon, that government does have a responsibility to protect those things which we hold in common trust, our air, our land, our water, our children. The first Earth Day was one of the largest demonstrations of public opinion in the history of this country. And it launched a generation of environmental protection that has given us a cleaner environment, that has created more jobs than most could have imagined. We have made real progress. We no longer have rivers that catch on fire, water bodies that used to be virtual sewage dumps are now vital, thriving places where people swim and fish. Boston Harbor, Puget Sound, Santa Monica Bay are on the rebound. Our skies are cleaner. In virtually every city in this country, the air is cleaner than it was 25 years ago. Smog is down. Carbon monoxide is down. By banning lead in gasoline, we have reduced the level of lead in the air by 98% and protected millions of children from permanent mental damage. In just the last 2 years, the Clinton administration has reduced toxic air pollution from chemical plants by 90% and set tough new standards for incinerators. In cities such as Detroit, Miami, San Francisco, industry, small businesses, schools, city government, and millions of ordinary citizens have joined together and made changes in their everyday behavior that has resulted in cleaner air for all to breathe. We've protected the public from toxic chemicals and hazardous waste. We banned DDT. Industrial emissions of toxic chemicals have decreased. Hundreds of toxic dump sites have now been cleaned up, and the creation of new toxic dump sites has all but been eliminated. Across this country, American industry accepted its responsibility. Thanks to environmental laws that required them to change their ways, companies as large as the biggest manufacturers in America and companies as small as the dry cleaner on the corner now consider pollution control to be a part of how they do business. The auto industry accepted the technological challenge to reduce air pollution, and compared to 25 years ago, today's new cars use only a third as much gas and emit 90% less pollution. Small businesses accepted their responsibility with the help of EPA, small printing companies have found ways to stop using polluting solvents. Small metal finishers have found opportunities to reuse metals that they would otherwise dump in the sewer. And some in industry and small business have even gone further. Thousands of enlightened businesses not only comply with environmental laws today, but take on the responsibility to do more, to go beyond mere compliance. In the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, the number of companies voluntarily committing to prevent pollution by conserving water, saving energy, cutting air pollution, has increased by nearly 75%. We in government and all of us in this country can be proud of what we have accomplished in the last 25 years. But if we are to be successful in solving the problems of today and meeting the challenges of the next 25 years, we must capture the imagination, creativity, tenacity that has made this country so great, that allowed us to put a man on the moon in a mere 8 years. Government's responsibility today is to create the opportunity to provide the flexibility so that the best answers, the best solutions can emerge. There is no doubt in my mind that an informed and involved industry, community, citizenry will always do a better job than some distant bureaucracy. For the last 2 years, we in the Clinton administration have committed ourselves to creating new opportunities for all Americans to participate in protecting their environment, industry, community, individuals, to do what they best can do to protect that which we all share. Through our Common Sense Initiative, the Clinton administration has brought people to the table to put their heads together, to find new solutions for major industries, solutions never before thought possible, to achieve results that are cleaner for the environment, cheaper for the taxpayer and industry, and smarter for the future of this country. Through our Community Environmental Protection Program, the Clinton administration is bringing people together to take a comprehensive look at how best to protect their community, their neighborhood, how best to make the tough decisions, the tough choices, to find solutions that work best for them. What is right for the Florida Everglades will not necessarily be right for the Chesapeake Bay. A brownfield revitalization in Detroit will be different than one in Cleveland. Community by community, we are creating a new generation of environmental protection, and we are seeing the results. The San Francisco Bay Delta, we ended 30 years of water wars by recognizing that the competing demands for scarce resources had to be solved not through confrontation, but by building consensus, by listening, by working together. Farmers, families, fishermen, all have a right to water. By bringing these people together, now all will have the water they need. Fundamental to full and meaningful participation is access to information, and that is why we have expanded the Community Right to Know program, giving citizens more information about toxic pollution in their neighborhoods so they can have the tools to protect themselves, their children, their neighborhood. On this 25th anniversary of Earth Day, it is appropriate to rejoice in the progress that we have made. But simply because we have solved some of the more obvious problems, we cannot declare that our responsibility has ended, our job is done, our commitment can waver. Our commitment cannot waver. The job is not done. The responsibility is still ours. Today, we must renew the resolve that 20 million Americans made 25 years ago to manage responsibly the natural resources upon which life depends. There are those who claim that all we have left is the pointless pursuit of trivial risks. They are dead wrong. Water, the basis of life itself, despite all of our progress, 40% of our rivers, our lakes, our streams are still not suitable for fishing, for swimming. Today, more than 1,000 warnings in rivers, lakes across this country telling pregnant women, children, don't eat the fish from your local river, your local lake. 30 million people in this country get their drinking water from systems that violated public health standards in the last year. 100 people died in Milwaukee from their tap water. Hundreds of thousands were sick for 7-10 days. 2 out of 5 Americans still live in a city where the air does not meet public health standards. Asthma has risen 40% in little more than a decade. And a recent study shows that soot, tiny particles of air pollution, pose a much greater risk, taking years off of the lives of Americans. 1 in 4 Americans still live within 4 miles of a toxic dump site. In 30 years, after Rachel Carson warned of the dangers of pesticide use, we have doubled the number of pounds of chemicals we use in producing the food we eat. 1 in 9 American women will develop breast cancer during her lifetime. The incidence of breast cancer has climbed 2% per year since the first Earth Day. Prostate cancer is rising 4% per year. There are many scientists who believe that the increase in these cancers is due to environmental factors. We must find the answers. Despite the ban on lead in gasoline, millions of American children still have dangerous levels of lead in their blood, a poison that damages their bodies and stunts their learning. We must accept the responsibility to protect our children. The job is not done. We are engaged today in perhaps what is the most important environmental debate in 25 years. The question before us is whether we will renew our responsibility to those things we hold in common, government, industry, all of us, or whether we will abdicate that responsibility. Will we seize the opportunities that lie before us, or will we squander those opportunities? Will we continue to place the responsibility in the hands of the people of this country, or will we place the responsibility in the hands of a few, the special interest, the polluters? Today, there are those who would take away opportunity from the people of this country, away from the people who want to fish in the rivers, drink safe, clean water from the tap, away from the parents who want their children to be able to play in a park that is safe, away from people who want to breathe clean air, away from government who has a responsibility to protect its people. There are those who ignore government's accomplishments, who belittle the profound commitment that mainstream America has to a healthy environment, who would casually turn back the clock to a time when American rivers caught fire and the lead in the air poisoned our children. In the past 100 days, we have seen actions that threaten to roll back the progress of 25 years and undermine virtually every public health and environmental protection that we have come to depend on. We have heard a member of the congressional leadership declare that DDT is not harmful and call for a shutdown of all environmental regulations. We have seen votes cast in Congress on legislation that would provide more protection for polluters than for ordinary Americans who depend on clean air, clean water, safe land for their economic and environmental health. We have seen lawyers and lobbyists for polluters invited into the back rooms of Congress, where behind closed doors, without public scrutiny, without public debate, they have written for themselves special exemptions from environmental responsibilities. We have seen a bill passed by a House committee that would increase the amount of sewage and industrial waste pouring into our rivers and streams, a bill that would allow the loss of over half of this country's wetlands, a bill that systematically undermines each and every one of the tools we have used for the last 25 years to clean up our water. We've seen members of Congress vowing to rewrite the Clean Air Act, again, to reverse the progress of the last 25 years. And we've seen legislation that would add more than 100 new opportunities for special interests to tie up the work that we do, to tie up the public health protections we seek to set. We've seen legislation that would use taxpayers' money to pay polluters not to pollute. And we have heard of proposals that Superfund should be amended so that the public, rather than the polluter, would pay to clean up the contaminated land. Whose interest does it serve if we shift this burden from the polluters to the American taxpayer? This administration came to Washington. I came to this job because I recognized that we needed to change the process by which we meet our public health and environmental goals. And for 2 years, we have engaged in a serious discussion and debate over how best to reform the process, to make it more flexible, more cost-effective, more sensible, more protective. But there is a difference between reform and repeal. What we are seeing today is an effort to roll back progress, to stop in our tracks, all under the rhetorical cover of job creation, wage enhancement, sounder science. If Congress is intent on reversing the commitment that they and all of us made to public health and our environment over 25 years, they have an obligation to inform and involve the American people in that debate. The public health protections that have been guaranteed the American people in the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act should not be changed without full and thorough public debate. They should not be casually swept away. I believe that as the head of this country's environmental agency, I have a responsibility and an obligation to speak out. And I will continue to do so if I believe that vital public health and environmental protections are in danger of being undermined or eliminated. After all of the progress we have made since the first Earth Day 25 years ago, we cannot go back. We must go forward. What has made this country great is our willingness to take on the tough jobs, to rise to the challenges, to seek new frontiers. We have fought for democracy and economic prosperity. We have fought for equality, and we have reached the moon. Now we must continue our fight to protect those things which we share, to protect the health of our children. There may have been some 25 years ago when we began this work who believed that in the course of a few short years, the job would be done. The reality is the job of environmental protection is never done. We must be ever vigilant, ever constant in our efforts. Let us celebrate 25 years of progress, but also let us pledge to renew our commitment to honor our responsibility and to seek new opportunities to move forward so that we can be proud to pass along to our children, our children's children, a healthy, safe, and prosperous world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now comes the hard part. We have a whole bunch of questions here. The Senate version of what is termed as regulatory reform passed 100-0. While you may not wish to endorse specific legislation, do you support the Senate proposal in general? And if not, do you support any increase in congressional regulatory oversight?
I presume that the question either goes to a bill that was passed last year, the Johnston reg reform bill, or perhaps the moratorium legislation that was passed more recently in this Congress. What I think is generally referred to as the regulatory reform bill, the cost-benefit risk assessment legislation, has not yet come to the Senate floor. It has passed in the House, and we believe that that bill passed by the House, the Job Creation and Wage Enhancement Act, would essentially prevent us from doing the job that the American people expect of us. We recognize and welcome the oversight that Congress must provide as the executive branch seeks to implement legislation. And so a 45-day holdover passed by the Senate that would allow Congress to look at an individual rule adopted by an agency, a standard set, is not inappropriate. We think that is a proper exercise of authority and recognizes our tradition in our government of a separate executive branch from our legislative branch. The moratorium passed by the House, which would prevent EPA and all other regulatory agencies from adopting any standards for the next year, is not an appropriate allocation of authority. The executive branch has the responsibility to implement the laws passed by Congress, and that responsibility should not be taken away, through a moratorium. If they don't like the laws they pass, then they should change the laws. But they should allow the executive branch to act.
Well, to help our television audience understand the whole issue here, can you address this question? What's wrong with saying that the government should not impose new regulations unless the costs are justified by the benefits? Isn't that just common sense?
We have no disagreement with those who say use all of the tools available in making the tough decisions. Risk assessments, we did more than 1,000 risk assessments at EPA last year. Cost-benefit analysis, every major rule I have adopted, every standard I have set since coming to the agency involved a cost-benefit analysis. Our objection is with those who seek to limit the tools in the toolbox or who seek to dictate the outcome of a particular decision by tying it to a simple analysis. Cost-benefit is a very important tool. We must use it. We do use it. We have expanded the use of it. But to require in every single instance that the dollar amount be applied to human lives, to IQ points lost in our children, and that then juxtaposed to the cost associated with providing those protections, and to deny us the right to act when the benefits are not such that they clearly outweigh the cost is unfair to the American people. My job is to protect people. It's not to wait to see how awful the problem is, wait for the children to be affected. We want to use these tools, we will continue to use them, but we should not be limited in the tools we use in making the tough decisions that we make.
Do you have a commitment for from the president to veto any of the environmental rewrites working their way through Congress? If so, where are you prepared to draw the line?
Well, the president has been very clear that he will use the veto if necessary to protect our air, our land, our water, the health of our children. We are in the middle of a legislative process, a debate that makes it extremely difficult for any of us to understand what a final bill will look like. But the president is absolutely clear that he will not be a party, and in all of my conversations with him, is quite elegant on his commitment to guaranteeing these protections to the American people and his willingness to use the veto if necessary.
Several questions on the Clean Air Act. What is the future of the Clean Air Act, and what parts of the act are most likely to be reformed or repealed?
The Clean Air Act, which we are now in the process of implementing, was passed by Congress in 1990 and was the subject of many years of debate, in some instances 2, 3, 4 years, other portions actually for 10 years. We do not think at this point in time Congress should change the law. We believe that it is a good law, that it is a flexible law, and that we can work within the existing Clean Air Act to achieve strong public health protections in a common sense, cost-effective manner. We have been working with the states who have a large responsibility for the day-to-day implementation of the Clean Air Act. They came to an initial meeting with us back in December with 65 concerns they had as to how we were moving forward with implementation. And in the course of just one meeting, we resolved 62 of those concerns. By sitting down, working together, we have been able to solve the problems, the concerns that have been raised as to the process of implementation within the Clean Air Act. We continue to believe that strong standards, public health standards, are essential, and that law provides us the opportunity and requires us in setting national air quality standards to guarantee the American people that their health will be protected, and we do not think that should be changed.
Do you believe the administration will be able to reach a compromise with Republicans on their desire to repeal retroactive liability for Superfund? If so, can you provide some insight as to what the compromise might be, and you might explain what retroactive liability means for the people out there?
The issue within the Superfund program goes to who pays and how that payment is allocated. President Clinton and I fought hard last year to see Superfund reauthorized. We believe the program is broken. It needs to be fixed. We have done everything we can within the existing statute. This is a case where we would ask Congress to act and to act expeditiously. The bill they had before them last year, as you said earlier, was supported by everyone from the Sierra Club to the Chemical Manufacturers Association. There has never been a piece of environmental legislation to enjoy that breadth of support. At the end of the day, we do not think the American taxpayers should be asked to pay to clean up the pollution. We believe the polluters should pay. That is a concept embodied in the original law that should be retained. How you allocate responsibility among the polluters, the process you use for determining who pays what share, that should be changed. We proposed last year a system that would have brought everyone to the table and used mediators. Get it away from the lawyers. Get it out of the courtrooms. But at the end of the day, we should not see some huge public works program created, some large tax placed on the American people to clean up this pollution.
With the latest relaxation of vehicle emission standards, does that mean if we don't continue to reduce air pollution from automobiles, will factories and other sources of pollution be forced to do more to reduce emissions?
Whoever gave me this question, I want to thank you.
Okay.
We haven't changed. No, and I think this question, I think, illustrates how difficult change can be for people to understand. We have not changed the standards for automobile tailpipe inspections. What we have changed is the process. The standards are the same. The protections that will be given the American people are the same. But the means by which we will meet those protections have been changed. It has been made more flexible, easier for the consumer, easier for the state. The cost of improving air quality when done through a tailpipe inspection program is $500 a ton for VOCs. A similar reduction from a smokestack is anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000 a ton. Tailpipe inspection programs are a common sense, cost-effective way to clean up the air that we breathe. And every time you get your car inspected, you are doing your part for cleaner air. You are accepting your responsibility to do everything you can for your children, for your community. We have not changed the standards. We will not change the standards. But if there is a way to provide flexibility, a simpler way to get the job done, then we will change the process.
Well, speaking of automobiles, will EPA hold firm on enforcing its reformulated gasoline policy? And what about Wisconsin?
90 million people today are using cleaner gasoline. Every time you fill up your car here in the D.C. area, you're doing your part to clean the air. This is gasoline that has fewer toxic emissions associated with it, less benzene. And we have been working to make sure in communities across the country that people understand the benefits of cleaner gasoline, and where there are questions, to answer those questions. We believe that cleaner gasoline is an essential part of a clean air program for this country.
What is EPA doing to streamline, consolidate environmental permits? Why can't there be just one permit to cover both air emissions and water releases?
We are moving in that direction. Under the regulatory reinvention package that the President announced on March 16th, we committed, as some of the changes we are undertaking, to move towards a one rule per industry. So first we will work within the air arena to take all of the various air rules that might apply to a particular facility. In the case of some, it's as many as 13. Consolidate those 13 rules into one rule for those industrial facilities. When we have completed that, we will then bring in the waste, the water rules. The goal is one industry, one rule, one permit.
Will EPA send legislation covering landfills, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act legislation, to the Hill this session?
We have not made a decision as to whether or not we will send RCRA legislation to the Hill this session. We are looking at the RCRA law, looking at the program, to determine if there might be, in some instances, very specific changes within the existing law that would give us greater flexibility to accomplish the goals of the program. But we have not made a decision.
There seems to be an anti-recycling movement brewing in this country. What place do you see for recycling in waste management and its prospects?
Well, I think we've made tremendous progress in this country in terms of our recycling efforts, and there are estimates now that in the next 4 years we will be able to significantly reduce the amount of waste each of us generates on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, and that is in large part due to the efforts we have made and the tremendous progress we have made in our recycling programs. Since coming to the agency, I have worked to connect the dots, if you will. We have these programs out, the curbside programs to collect the waste. We have an interest in the part of industry in reusing the waste, but those relationships were not what they need to be so that we would have a sophisticated system, a sophisticated enterprise. And we did work with the Chicago Board of Trade that is going to computerize all of the interchanges that are necessary so that someone who collects the waste will be able to put up on a computer system, they have X pounds of this, and someone who needs it will be able to buy it off the system, bringing those in need together with those who are collecting, connecting the dots that have not heretofore been connected, closing the loop so that the system becomes more efficient and can expand even more.
Why don't you push for disposal of radiation waste in the deep ocean?
You know, if 25 years has taught us anything, it should be that out of sight, out of mind solutions don't tend to work very well. What we have to be about is reducing the amount of waste we generate, reusing, recycling, and then, and only then, looking to disposal. I think it is not wise, whether it be in this instance or any instance when we dispose of waste, to try and simply get it as far away and as deep under as possible. It doesn't necessarily provide the protections that are important to the people and that we have a responsibility to give the people.
At a time when Congress is likely to cut dramatically federal aid at EPA and other agencies, are you concerned about the ability of state and local governments to keep pace with public environmental expectations?
Obviously, this is a time of difficult resources, money to do this job has become increasingly constrained. And we are working with state, local governments to understand what each of us can best do in this job of environmental and public health protection. There are some things that the federal government can do better than state and local government. There are other things that state and local government can do better than the federal government. I come from a large state environmental agency. I have a great deal of appreciation for the skills and the strengths that they have. But I think we would all agree that a federal agency setting national drinking water standards, national air quality standards, is something important in this country. We want to be able to know when we travel from Washington to San Francisco that the water we drink is safe. And the way to make the best use of the dwindling resources available to this job is to understand which level of government can best meet the challenge, can best solve the problem.
This comes from the audience, not me, right? Speaker Gingrich has said that your agency operates the most effective inner-city job-killing program in the nation. How do you respond to that?
Well, I read that, and I will be honest with you, I was perplexed. I think he was referring to our Brownfields Revitalization Program, which is doing an awful lot to bring hope, to bring jobs back to the inner city. There are, in every city in this country, far too many communities, neighborhoods, blocks, where a piece of property is fenced off because of contamination. It is not available to that community for redevelopment. A year ago, we launched the Brownfields Revitalization Program, designed to get those sites redeveloped. And we've already been successful at many of them. And we just added another round of sites to the list. And we took 23,000 of these inner city sites off of the Master Superfund list so they would be eligible for redevelopment. I visited one of these sites in a very poor, rundown, many parts of the community abandoned. And I saw a facility that had been cleaned up, restored, brought back to life. And 30 people are employed there today that didn't have jobs previously. And across the street, the housing has now been restored. And they're talking about another revitalization project just a few blocks over. We are bringing jobs and hope back to the inner city through our Brownfield Revitalization Program.
This has been a presentation of the National Press Club and the Internet Multicasting Service.